This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, Selena Green with you for The Country Hour on this Monday. Yes, me again, back in the hot seat. Cassie Huff is still a little under the weather. It's just that time of the year. There seems to be a lot of bugs going around and they're just hanging on. So hopefully you're listening in healthy and happy wherever you are today. But yeah, it is just that time of the year when things do the rounds, especially if you've got young ones in the family and there's always stuff coming home. Great to be with you on this Monday, and I'm with you right through until 1 o'clock today. Coming up on the program, the South Australian River Murray irrigators have received their opening water allocations for the coming year. So what percentage have they been given and how are they feeling about that announcement? Well, you'll find out very shortly. Also, after years and years of some significant turnoff, is Australia finally in a rebuilding phase when it comes to our sheep flock? Well, current data is saying something a little bit different than what it was saying. So you'll hear more about that in this next hour as well. If you'd like to join me at any time throughout the program, anything you'd like to weigh in on, or perhaps you had some rain over the weekend and want to share a rainfall figure, the talkback number is 1300 160222, or you can text me at any time this afternoon on 0467 922 783. But let's get into it, because yes, the government has today, even this morning, just announced the 2026-27 opening water allocations for South Australia's River Murray irrigators, and it's landed at 83%. Now, that is an increase on the minimum allocation of 62% that the Department of Water projected back in mid-April, which it says was then based on the Murray-Darling Basin Authority's worst case water availability. Now, making the announcement today, the department says the higher opening allocation of 82% reflects improved water availability across the River Murray system. It's also indicated that percentage could increase, with current projections indicating a high likelihood, using their words, of allocations reaching 100% under most scenarios. Courtney Hume is a Loxton-based wine grape grower. She's also on the Riverland Wine Grape Growers Association board. I spoke with her a short time ago and just asked her if she was surprised by the announcement today of 83% given the previous projection.
They indicated that they would keep releasing if there was going to be an increase, and they still will, because it hasn't gotten to 100%. So these announcements will keep coming out, whether it's staying at this percentage or it is increasing. We were obviously very hopeful with the rains that have been coming through that this increase, that there would be an increase in the allocation.
So I don't imagine 62%, that was a would have been much of a welcome prospect if that's where it had landed.
No, it was did make us question what we would be doing going forward. We like to spread our risk in our business as best as we can in regards to the water market, as we do rely on temporary water. So the increase has been very much welcomed in our business. It doesn't mean that there will necessarily be a reduction in price immediately, but it will help reduce some of the reliance on temporary water purchases for certain irrigators.
How do you think other irrigators in the district will be feeling about this, that 83% is workable?
Any increase is welcome from the 62%, that's for sure. We're not at 100% yes and 100% yet, and that would definitely be the ideal, but it will give a little bit more confidence going into the season, but it would be great to hopefully get to the 100% mark if possible.
Yeah, are you feeling pretty confident about that? Of course, the Department of Water has flagged a high likelihood of allocations you're reaching that 100%, but of course it's never a guarantee. But does that give you some confidence?
Any indication that there's the potential for it to get to 100% gives us a little bit of hope, but we don't rely on it until we've actually been told that news. We will go into the season with what it's predicted at the moment and plan with that.
Yeah, so 83%, that's what you've got for now. This is what you go forward with your planning. So what does that change mean to you for your plans for the rest of the year? What do you do now that you've got that announcement? What happens next for you?
just because allocations, even if they do get to 100%, doesn't mean that we're going to be paying less for water. It's the demand for the water that's there. So you can't guess what the water market's going to be doing in a month, in 2 months. There's so many different factors that change what you're paying for water. As I just said, for our business, we just choose to spread our risk and we look into different options to make sure we've got security there and try to plan forward as best as we can and not rely month to month on the water that we do need.
That is Loxton Irrigator Courtney Hume speaking to me earlier there. So those allocations will be issued for use from the 1st of July this year. In its announcement today, the Department of Environment and Water said further allocation improvements during 2026-27 remain possible, with most River Murray system inflows historically occurring between July and November. It said current projections indicate, as I said earlier, a high likelihood of allocations reaching 100% under most scenarios. However, future improvements are not guaranteed, with the three-month Bureau of Meteorology outlook indicating that below average rainfall is expected in parts of the Murray-Darling Basin. As the projected minimum opening allocation for 2026-27 is greater than 50%, under the rules, irrigators will not be eligible to carry over any unused allocation volumes from 25-26 into the coming year. Department Water Delivery Manager Renee Thompson said this increase in the projection is good news for irrigators and should give them more confidence for decision making. That takes us to 11 minutes past 12. Well, speaking of water, balancing your books is a big part of farming, including managing water entitlements. And that may get a bit tougher with river irrigators receiving this opening water allocation of 83% for the coming year. With potential fines for overuse, how can water users do more with less? Well, Swan Systems Irrigation Manager Tom Hatcher says water budgeting can help.
As farmers know, water budgeting is paramount to numerous things in growing crops. Obviously, you get a water entitlement, so you have to stay within the bounds of those entitlements. But getting that wrong can have a vast array of problems. But the most basic level of water budgeting, I suppose, is creating a monthly budget, which can then be broken down to weekly, daily. And then I suppose what determines that is the water entitlement that you've got for the season at its most basic level. So at Swan, we kind of look at the crop water demand for specific phenological periods of the crop that you're growing. So we've got an idea of, you know, when are peak irrigation times of the season, when do we need to have enough water in the bank to cover those periods. But we're also looking at historical weather data to determine, along with what the crop water demand is, exactly where that water should be divided. So it can be a very basic thing. So growers can, I suppose, create their own water budget off, you know, what they deem to be certain periods throughout the season where they need to allocate their water. But that's one we can definitely get more specific and work off what we use in our algorithm, which is a crop coefficient. So we kind of nail it down to a more valve-by-valve basis crop water demand, which can lead the water budget.
As you said, you've got your water entitlements and there's what water you actually use. What you're allowed to use. And then if you use more than what you're actually entitled to, how do you work that back out?
I suppose we're tracking, you know, every irrigation application we are tracking through our platform. So we, as I mentioned before, we use pre-existing harbour out in the field to bring that data in and consolidate it and act off that data. So we're connected by API to the irrigation controller, which then tells us how much has been irrigated across the whole farm and then on a valve basis. So I suppose when, you know, some of the issues that we can run into when over-irrigating is obviously breaching your entitlement. So there's fines involved with that, but there's also other issues that growers will face. So if you're over irrigating, often you'll have quality issues on your crop. So if you're growing, you know, a crop with a canopy, so a grapevine or you've got a citrus farm or an avocado farm, over irrigating at the wrong time of season can really push that canopy to grow out of balance with the amount of fruit you've got. So that can create a whole heap of issues down the line. So we're basically putting the crop and leaf area out of balance. We're shading fruit, you know, which really impedes quality. So we're not getting that good maturation of sugars throughout the ripening process. Basically, it's costing us more money by irrigating more. We're growing a bigger canopy. We're going to need more tractor passes to trim the canopy. There's going to be disease issues. We're going to have to spray more fungicide, insecticide, and even more herbicide. If you can be growing grass under your trees or your vines, and you're basically feeding the grass by over-irrigating. So, yeah, there's a whole heap of issues down the line from over-irrigating. Often we think, you know, apply more water, we're going to get a bigger crop and we're going to have a better outcome. But, yeah, there's lots of issues that can come from it. Not only that, it can impede yield too. So in crops where you're relying on, you know, bud fruitfulness that's determined the prior season, if we've got excess shading over the bud during that period around flowering, you know, that can impede yield in subsequent seasons.
The last few years in South Australia, water entitlements have been at 100%, but now the next coming water year, entitlements are at 62%. It's been a while since they've been less than 100%. How will this all fit for growers working out their water use for the next year and obviously managing that?
It's very tough. It's going to be tough, extremely tough. If a grower's faced with just a massive cut or a third of the amount of water that they're used to operating with, or two-thirds, sorry, if they're operating within a system where they're not looking at irrigating on a valve level, if they're more, I don't like using this word, but blanket irrigating across a whole crop type and farm, you know, you can be in trouble because basically whatever crop you're growing has built up a tolerance for a certain amount of water, and then when you pull that back, suddenly it has disastrous effects.
Tom Hatcher there. He is the irrigation manager with Swan Systems, and he was speaking there to Eliza Berlage. It's almost 17 minutes past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
With Selena Green on this Monday. Well, after a few years of heavy turnoff, is Australia finally in the process of rebuilding its sheep flock? And the number of sheep and lambs leaving properties for slaughter or export has been significant in recent years. There were some signs that had stabilised and the industry was edging closer to recovery, if not already in it. One analyst says that rebuild has been pushed further out with a substantial rethink of where the national flock is at. Matt Dalgleish from Episode 3 joins me. Matt, welcome to The Country Hour. Many thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Lena. Thanks for having me on.
So you've been looking at some more recent data around Australia's flock numbers, and they're telling a bit of a different story as to whether or where we are in terms of any rebuild. How is the new data sort of telling you a different story from what we've seen previously?
Yeah, that's right. And it's in conjunction with the MLA sheep industry outlook. So if you look back to the September report of last year, MLA had a rebuild, looking forward from kind of now through to 2027, they were expecting a rebuild, but they've revised their figures. So the most recent March report incorporated the changes to both ABS estimates for flock and also that updated the MLA one. So we saw quite a significant change to the MLA outlook from September last year to March of this year. And now they've basically had the flock in decline since about 2023, and they're projecting the flock to continue to decline out to 2028 on current estimates. And that kind of makes a bit more sense with what we've been seeing, both in terms of the wool clip dropping away as that flock's got smaller, but also the really high prices we've seen in the last few years for lamb and for mutton, and that's carried through to this year as well. It fits with that much tighter scenario.
So, when you layer these two, I guess, different data sets over the top of each other, is it quite a substantial change in understanding of where the numbers have come from and where they've landed?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at just how much the flock was cut in the forecast between the two MLA reports, we're talking about a drop of nearly 13 million head in the flock in terms of a revision. So, and that's, you know, downwards. So that's a big adjustment when you're considering that the flock is around that kind of, well, it was sitting historically up around the 75 million and heading towards 80 million head, and now it's down below 70 million head and heading towards 65 million head. So not just the existing position where we are now, but also what's expected over the next few years has got a significant change to flock numbers. you know, as we widen out towards 2027, 2028, that difference is kind of heading more towards 15 million head. So that's, you know, 15 million fewer sheep and lambs, which is obviously accounting for a much tighter scenario, both for the wool market and for the sheep meat market.
Yeah, so when you look at the, I guess, that turn-off ratio, those number or that number of sheep being turned off, obviously that is that has been then, and it probably hasn't been seen in the data until now, is that that turn-off has been coming off a much smaller overall flock number than we had previously thought.
Yeah, that's right. So that's meant that the actual ratio of turn-off was higher than what we'd anticipated, which coincides then much closely with those flock being in decline. So effectively, the sheep turn-off ratio, you know, in light of the adjustments that both the ABS and MLA have put out, that's revised the recent history in terms of sheep turn-off. And that has also pointed to us being in a liquidation phase for the last 3 years, including this year. The interesting thing is that when you look at the ABS data, as at the end of March, we have noted that we're on the cusp, as according to the sheep turn-off ratio, we are on the cusp of a rebuild. However, MLA are continuing to forecast liquidation for this year, 2027 and to 2028, which is an interesting kind of take on it. It'll probably depend upon how the year plays out. Now that we've started to see some rain, particularly in some of the southern areas, and the autumn breaks come through, MLA may revise their estimates, and certainly the sheep turnoff ratio is a bit of a delayed indicator. We'll keep an eye on that as the year progresses, because it's looking like we could be heading towards a rebuild quicker than what MLA are anticipating. But we're going to have to wait to see what the June numbers come, and they'll be out in another month or so. So, we've just got to see how that plays out. But, it's an interesting time, because we're potentially, some of the data is not quite corresponding to what the MLA forecasts are predicting at the moment.
That turnoff in that period, 2024-25, that's when the sort of, I guess it was at its most severe?
Yes, that's right. And we did a bit of a look at further ABS data, just looking at the, how the ABS data, what that was telling us about lamb availability through that period. And we did see in that time that previous years we'd seen a bit more of lamb availability, but through 2024-25, that was when that really started to tighten that market, and that corresponded with that surge in pricing we saw through winter in particular, and it's carried us through actually to this year as well, Selena. So, the ongoing tightness of that both lamb and mutton supply is why we're seeing, fairly strong pricing this year as well. And as we head into winter, that's probably expected to continue.
As you say, there is a little bit of a lag in the data telling us where we are, as we speak. But do we call this a period of stability, that fair to say that the worst is over?
Look, it's certainly the supply and demand. From a producer perspective, the supply and demand picture domestically is one of it's favouring the producer. And even despite us seeing a little bit weaker export markets as at the start of this year, we've seen a softening of export demand. But prices here have held up incredibly well despite that softening of export demand. So that does really explain as well what's going on there with the tighter supply and a bit of a weaker demand picture globally. That's why the prices have held up, because that supply has been so tight. It's kind of both sides of the market have contracted and prices have held up. So it just shows that I think for this year and potentially next, we might see slightly weakening pricing over the period, but it's going to remain at fairly historically high levels just because the broader supply and demand picture is still favouring the producer.
This is a slow ship to turn around, though. There's obviously some challenges to rebuilding.
Yeah, that's right. And the biggest one now facing us, there's probably two. One on the market side is that at these high prices, we are in some markets meeting some demand resistance, because sheep meat is really still considered in most markets offshore a commodity item. So we do need to do a lot of work as an industry to build that value base and that that kind of objective carcass measurement, the things that MLA and some of the meat scientists at the University of New England are working on, trying to kind of build that capacity to demonstrate quality and value and consistency. And the other thing, obviously, that's concerning the domestic market is the discussions that we may be heading towards an El Nino, a super, and they're referring to it as a super El Nino, which often pushes us much more into a drier scenario and drought picture. We haven't seen it completed just yet, but that is a lingering concern too, that if we go into a drier spell, that could put a halt to this potential rebuild, and then that would probably then put the MLA numbers more in play in terms of continued liquidation down towards those lower 60 millions kind of in terms of in what they're forecasting out to 2028.
There's always so many factors at play that it is very hard to predict. Speaking of factors in play, obviously this year the Middle East conflict has sort of thrown all sorts of spanner in the works. And Matt, look, this could change in the moments that we're talking, having, you know, looked at this scenario. But, you know, talking today around a possible peace deal and an end to this conflict, this would be quite a sigh of relief, I imagine, for a lot of producers out there.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly on the input side of things, you know, in terms of securing, we have seen a bit of a drop away in fertiliser and fuel pricing and back to more normal levels. That's probably helped that movement is the fact that we may be getting much closer to a ceasefire and a peace deal and an opening of the Strait of Hormuz. I note that it has been mentioned several times. I think we're up to about 40 that President Trump and his administration have said the deal's not far away. So it's probably, we'd like to see it come through and then stay, you know, as a real peace deal, and that includes the opening of the strait. I think that's what we really need to see to really ensure that that cost price squeeze is over. And also the other good thing from the sheep market, if that Strait of Hormuz was open, would mean that we're access back to the Middle East and North African region would be back to normal, and that's one of those markets that we have seen reduced demand for sheep meat just because of the difficulty in accessing. So that would be another positive for the producer, not so much on the cost side, but on the opening up of a key market for our exports.
Well, let's hope this time it sticks. As we'll say, we'll have to watch this space.
Absolutely.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us on The Country Hour today. It's always great to pick your brain. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Selena. Thanks for having me.
Matt Dugleish there from Episode 3's Market Analyst with Episode.3. It is 27 minutes past 12. You are with Selena Green on The Country Hour today. We're talking about water allocations earlier. Joe is in the Southern Flinders Ranges. Joe hopped on the text line to say, listening to the water issues just now for allocations, Joe says, thinking, are we going to run the river dry with a huge volume of water that the data centre to be built near Morgan will require? Certainly hearing a lot more concerns and questions, you know, as we hear these announcements of some of these data centres being built, not just here in South Australia, but other parts of the nation, and water a big concern for a lot of people with those projects. Fair question. That text line is 0467 922 783. But it is almost 28 minutes past 12, so we better head to the Weather Bureau. And Chris Kent is our forecast today. Chris, thanks for waiting on the phone for us.
No problem at all. How are you?
Very good on this Monday. And it looks like, well, we might have another sort of system coming across the state this week to maybe bring some more rain.
Yeah, it looks like we've got a good chance of seeing some good soaking rain again right across large parts of the state this week. Started today out in the west and starting to move across the Eyre Peninsula now with some showers sort of ahead of a warm front which is developing in the Bight. The few thunderstorms within that rain band as well, and since 9 a.m. We have recorded around 4 millimetres out on the Eyre Peninsula and in the far west, we're expecting plenty more of that to continue to fall. So that system is tapping into a bit of tropical moisture across the north, so dragging a cloud band down from the Pilbara in WA, right down through northern parts of SA and into the southeast over the course of the next couple of days. Tomorrow we'll see one of the wetter days of the week as that system starts to move across the state. The front will start bringing showers to large parts of the state and possibility of some thunderstorms in that as well, with some, I guess we could probably some locally heavy falls in some places. later in the week on Thursday, starting to see a little bit of a clearance from the northwest, but this is when the low itself is starting to push across the southern agricultural areas. So we'll start seeing we'll continue to see sort of showery and possible thunderstorms across the southern coast as we head into the weekend, and that low sort of drifts into the southeast. So some reasonable rainfall on the cards this week, and also some pretty warm temperatures as well. So while there's a fair bit of rain around, we are maintaining a northerly flow across most of the state until probably around Friday. With that northerly flow, we see those temperatures up above average, around 5 degrees or so above average in some places. So, reasonably mild week ahead as well. So over the next 4 days, rainfall totals, it's going to be highly dependent on the movement of this, the low pressure system itself, but generally we're looking at sort of around 10 to 40 millimetres across most of the state. The northeast pasture and sort of the far north, probably likely to see sort of the smaller totals this week, probably more so around sort of that 5 to 10 millimetre mark. But we will see areas of 40 to 70 millimetres across the southern parts of the northwest pastoral, the west coast, the lower Eyre Peninsula districts, and even sort of around Kangaroo Island and the Mount Lofty ranges. There's possibility of even seeing sort of some totals in excess of 70 millimetres across the next 4 days. So fair bit of rainfall to come. If we do sort of see some of that falling across the Mount Lofty ranges where it is, or the catchments are starting to get pretty wet, there's a possibility that we may see some minor flooding around sort of the Oatbank area, and there's possibility that we may see a flood watch sort of issued sort of through those areas at some point, but we'll see how we go in terms of the development of this system this week.
All right, Selena. Yeah, could be some interesting totals in there. All right, we'll keep across it. Thanks, Chris.
No worries.
Chris Kent there from the Weather Bureau. Some bit more rain, as you said, on its way. The western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, the upper western district, is looking at a partly cloudy Tuesday with northeasterly winds 20 to 30 k's an hour, with overnight temperatures falling to between 11 and 14 degrees and daytime temperatures reaching the low to mid 20s. Now for the lower western district, partly cloudy tomorrow with a medium chance of showers near the South Australian border, most likely in the morning, and then near zero chance of rain elsewhere. Winds north to northeasterlies 20 to 30 k's an hour with overnight temperatures there between 10 and 13 degrees, and during the day those temperatures should reach the low 20s. It is coming on to 27 minutes to 1.
Who will win the AI race? Has gambling become our national sport?
Questions. They've never been more important. So the one thing we'll never question is our duty to keep asking. ABC News, keep asking.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Great to have your company on this Monday. Well, wild dogs, are you having much of a problem with them at your place? Are you seeing an increase in numbers, or are you just finding that they are perhaps using some slightly different tactics? My talkback number today, 1300 160 222, or the text line 0467 922 783. I ask because along the South Australian-Victorian border, a fence is going to be built around five properties just on the Victorian side to protect those five farms from attacks on their livestock. But one of the farmers involved in that project is a bit worried that it is just going to push the problem off to other farms. That is coming up. But first this afternoon, the Australian government is going to be throwing some money at trying to keep a disease out of our country that has the potential to halt our livestock export trade if it reached our shores. The government's going to spend up to $1 million to help fight an outbreak of lumpy skin disease in barley. Now, this disease has been spreading throughout Indonesian cattle since 2022, and the Australian government has so far provided 1.4 million doses of the vaccine. As a highly contagious disease that affects cattle isn't in Australia, but an outbreak here could severely devastate our beef, dairy and livestock exports and deal a massive blow to the economy. So the government says the funding announced today will help protect Indonesian livestock industries and hopefully help prevent this disease from getting into Australia. Tom Robinson spoke with the Federal Minister for Ag, Fisheries and Forestry, Julie Collins.
What this means, of course, is that there'll be more vaccines available on the ground and help Indonesia help contain this lumpy skin disease. We do know that since 2022, it has spread across Indonesia, and we are working with the Indonesian government. We've now provided support of 1.4 million doses of lumpy skin disease vaccine to the government. We've also had our CSIRO, Centre for Disease Preparedness, working with the Indonesian government laboratories and surveillance. And we've also been doing some training to try and help in terms of the animal diseases in our region with them. So this is very significant. An additional $1 million we expect will purchase somewhere between 250 and 300,000 additional vaccines.
The messaging from government and industry when lumpy skin disease made it to Bali was, I guess, everyone should be alert, not alarmed. Has that situation changed? Has there been a big spike in cases to sort of inform this response now?
No, this is us continuing our work with the Indonesian government and us continuing to work with industry and with our partners in the region. Australia has a national lumpy skin disease preparedness plan, and we continue to work with our close neighbours on making sure that we do everything we can do to help them, but also help protect Australia's border, which is obviously really important to us as well.
What's the timeline for this rollout of the $1 million and the extra vaccines? Has it already started?
Well, we want to get it out there as quickly as we possibly can. And as I said, it does come on top of the fact that we've already provided over 1 million vaccines and working with the Indonesian government in terms of doing everything we can to lift in terms of their laboratories and surveillance and their training as well on the ground. So this is about, as I said, supporting our neighbour, but also about protecting our borders. I mean, we've now invested, since we've come to office, around $2 billion in additional funding for biosecurity since we've been in office. And that includes things like supporting our neighbours with these vaccines.
How would you characterise, I guess, the relationship with Indonesia on this management of lumpy skin disease? How important is Australia's assistance in this case?
Well, I think the assistance has been really welcomed by our near neighbours. You know, we've been doing a range of measures, you know, to decrease the risk for Australia in terms of our international travel and trade. We've been looking, you know, as I said, our preparedness plan. But importantly, we're doing everything we can to stop lumpy skin disease coming from Australia by working with our near neighbours like Indonesia. And we certainly know that in conversations we've had with the Indonesian government, they certainly appreciate our support and the work that we've been doing on the ground to assist them.
Does the spread of lumpy skin disease to Bali specifically increase risk to Australia any more than it would if it spread to another island in the Indonesian archipelago?
Yeah, well, we've obviously seen it in Indonesia. I think it's across 21 provinces and a range of islands there. So we're actively monitoring the situation, as you would expect us to. And as I said, since lumpy skin disease has been in Indonesia, we've, you know, checked our biosecurity settings, and we're very confident that our biosecurity settings and our border requirements are as appropriate as they need to be and will help us manage that risk. You know, we also said that travellers returning from Bali don't present an increase risks, provided they follow the standard biosecurity measures at the border. You know, we encourage people always to, you know, make sure they let us know where they've been and what they've been up to, and to fill in that traveller declaration card appropriately.
This sort of ongoing response and assistance to Indonesia, how do you measure the success of the program? Is eradication the goal? Is that possible? How would you sort of give it a big green tick?
Well, that will be obviously up to the Indonesian government, but any reduction or containment, I'm sure, would be welcomed. I mean, you know, Australia has been free from lumpy skin disease. We've never had an incursion here. We want to make sure that that remains the case, which is why we're also working with our near neighbours and helping them, you know, contain their outbreak, and we'll continue to do that.
I'm watching the TV here in the studio. You'd be aware of the news. The US and Iran have reached a peace deal, or a deal to suspend hostilities, I should call it. That's sort of just happening this morning, and I appreciate the government is probably still piecing together exactly what's happened. But what can you tell us at this stage? And, you know, obviously that's good news.
Well, obviously, the Prime Minister and our Foreign Minister have certainly welcomed the news about the peace deal in terms of the Middle East. I understand it's due to be ratified in a week's time. And certainly, as a government, we have always called for de-escalation. So we obviously welcome that de-escalation. And we also want to see that Strait of Hormuz, that's so important to the world's economy, reopen as soon as possible. And that's been our position really from day one. In the meantime, of course, we've been getting on. We've been doing everything we can do as a government to help shield Australians and particularly our primary producers, our farmers, from the worst impacts of this war in the Middle East, and we'll continue to do that. We're not sure yet, I guess, on obviously how long it'll take to get the strait open. We're not sure about how long a tail this is going to have, but we'll continue to work with industry in the sector and we continue to engage with them regularly on it.
That is the Federal Minister for Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, Julie Collins, speaking there to Tom Robinson. Well, with a ceasefire in place and the key players saying a Middle East peace deal has been agreed, it seems possible that shipping could resume through the Strait of Hormuz. That will be significant for the world economy, but Shipping Australia says the maritime sector has already made some significant changes to supply lines as a result of this conflict. David Claughton has this report.
Seafarers will be cheering if a peace plan proves durable. Many ships have been attacked just in the last week. People have lost their lives. Jim Wilson from Shipping Australia says three vessels were attacked by the US as it continued its blockade on Iran, including two oil tankers, the Marivex and the Jalvia.
So the other attack was the Setebello on the 9th of June. The Palo-flagged Setebello is an oil tanker. It was attacked in the Gulf of Oman, again a missile was fired into the ship's engine room after the crew did not comply with directions from US forces. Three seafarers are missing, presumed dead, following the attack. And then on the 11th of June, the US CENTCOM, so CENTCOM is the United States Central Command, it's got the area of responsibility for the Persian Gulf and much of the Gulf of Oman and the Arabian Sea. On the 11th of June, the Guinea-Bissau flagged Jaldir, which is an asphalt bitumen carrier, was attacked as it attempted to transport oil from Iran through the Gulf of Oman. So that's the body of water just to the right-hand side of the Strait of Hormuz. Again, US aircraft fired missiles into the ship's engine room after the crew repeatedly failed to comply with directions. As of 12th of June, US CENTCOM forces have disabled nine ships, redirected 135, and have allowed 42 vessels supporting humanitarian aid to pass the US blockade. Iranian forces have been harassing shipping as well. So this is not one side or the other, both sides have been doing it.
Despite the ongoing conflict and loss of life, fuel, fertiliser and chemicals have been finding a way out of the Middle East through a couple of terrestrial routes.
There's a pipeline that runs across the Arabian Peninsula under the sands of Saudi Arabia, and it goes to a port on the Red Sea, which is the other side away from the conflict. And that port is called Yanbu. It's a bit less in the line of fire. That's not to say it's completely out of the line of fire because it has been attacked. And that's got a capacity of 5 to 7 million barrels per day of exports. So it really, this is really important. When we see a lot of the analysis, and especially from the oil analysts, a lot of people say, oh, you know, the Strait of Hormuz, 20% of world oil, you know, production goes through the Strait of Hormuz, and that is true. However, a good 5 to 7 million barrels, which is about 7 to 10%, goes through Yanbu, or can go through Yanbu. So there's been a lot of oil movements out of Yanbu and through the Red Sea. Now, that, I think, has been a bit of a relief valve and has possibly stopped everything going very disastrously wrong for the world economy.
It's not the only new route for fuel to get out of the region.
The Emiratis are halfway through building a pipeline, I think, to Fujairah, and that is outside the Persian Gulf and outside the Strait of Hormuz. So if and when that is built, I suspect we will see the significance of the Strait of Hormuz declining over time. And then on top of that, we have all the renewable situation, and the people of the world is decarbonizing, is moving away from fossil fuels in every way. And I know a lot of organizations and people might not like to hear that, but it is true. We've been talking to a lot of the shipping guys, and they've been reporting, for example, they're carrying a lot more electric cars now than they've done previously.
So if this current ceasefire holds and shipping resumes through the Gulf, the supply of critical inputs for agriculture and mining to Australia will certainly ease. But Jim Wilson thinks the issue has largely been resolved anyway.
The stock holding of the various kind of fuels that Australia has actually gone up since before the conflict. So the amount of, you know, diesel and gasoline and so on that are being held in stockpiles in Australia is now more than it was before the conflict began. And there are a few reasons for that. I think a couple of the primary ones is the Prime Minister relaxed some of the environmental standards on what fuels can be refined in Australia. So I think that's been a factor as well. And also there's been, you know, some very highly publicised deals. But from the shipping perspective, I was speaking to a Shipping Australia member about this the other day. Ships are coming. It's business as usual. And, you know, I totally understand what you said, because we all thought the same thing too. But, you know, and the members were like, oh, no, things are going to be terrible. And everyone was a bit worried. And then, you know, we say, oh, well, we've got visibility for 4 weeks. We've got visibility for 6 weeks. But then there was visibility for 8 weeks. And now we found out the members who are involved in the oil and gas trade, and they say, yeah, we're not really seeing any change, to be honest. And we don't really foresee any change from what we can see at the moment.
That's Jim Wilson there from Shipping Australia, and he was speaking to David Claughton. It is 15 minutes to one.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green on this Monday. Well, the National Wild Dog Management Coordinator says Australia's livestock sector is winning the battle against feral dogs, but weather events like a big wet season in northern Australia can see populations surge again. Greg Mifsud has been the coordinator role for well over a decade, working with landholders across the nation to develop plans and teach best practice. He spoke with Matt Brown about the range of tactics that are being used across Australia to reduce dog attacks on livestock.
It's about using the range of tools that we have at our availability. So anything from, you know, dog baiting programs, the use of leg hold traps that have been around for centuries, but we've refined them and improved their capacity as well as their humaneness. We've got shooting, which is, you know, opportunistic at times, unless you're using thermal gear and it's a bit more targeted. But it's about, we've got fencing as well in different states and territories. You can also use guardian animals in some circumstances. So it's really about how to implement and integrate those range of tools for the landscape and the production setting that you're dealing with and the level of impact that you're faced with.
What is so clear speaking to you today, Greg, is that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution here when it comes to wild dogs. It's a complex story. There's so much to it. Do you think the livestock industry of Australia is winning the battle against wild dogs?
Oh, look, I certainly do. It ebbs and wanes. A big part of that complexity, as you suggested, is actually our landscape and our climate. So, you know, the NT, for instance, at the moment's just had a couple of massive wet seasons. You know, there's a lot of potential there for dogs and other animals to breed up now. And so when areas where we've, you know, had good control and really good management, then you get things like seasonal conditions, drought, floods that, you know, then, you know, cause fluctuations in populations of the pests as well as other things, and also puts additional stress on growers in terms of managing their livestock and stuff. So what we do see is that, you know, we have to have this constant, I guess, engagement at a local level to make sure that we've got landholders still moving forward with effective control programs, mm-hmm. And up-to-date information on how to use the new, you know, what tools we have as best we can in the situation we've got.
Is there a current estimate on how many wild dogs there are in Australia?
No, look, there isn't, and we don't attempt to. So at the end of the day, you know, our management and our control programs are put in place to reduce impact. It doesn't really matter how many dogs are out there from that perspective. If there's a lot of dogs out there doing nothing and not causing any harm, then so be it. But where we do have dogs causing impact, then we need to manage them. And that's really what our objectives are.
Now, just finally, Greg, we've heard stories about funding problems for your role and this program in general. Are you going to be around at the back end of this year to help producers?
Oh, look, I can't really comment on that. Certainly say we're working with industry and various government agencies to secure funding, but, yeah, I can't really comment any further.
Greg Mifsud there. He's the National Wild Dog Management Coordinator there, speaking to Matt Brown. So the future of the funding for his role, well, that is now in the hands of the government. and department to decide. Well, since we're speaking of dog attacks on livestock, the Victorian government is going to subsidise a 70-kilometre dingo exclusion fence bordering Big Desert Wilderness Park, which sits on the border of South Australia, in order to help protect livestock from attacks. Now, that fence will border a cluster of five farms worst affected by predation since legal control was banned in that part of Victoria 27 months ago. But local farmer Alan Bennett is concerned that this fence will only push the problem of dingo predation onto their neighbours.
85% of sheep deaths reported in the Big Desert have been sustained by the five of us since the lifting of the unprotection order on the 14th of March 2024. And after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and talking, and basically we've had no support whatsoever apart from a few cameras set up. And at the end, we've come to this point where they're prepared to support us with some boundary exclusion fencing to try and secure just our little local area. It's a barrier fence around all the five of us sort of almost, well, we virtually touch. So the fence can take a continuous path around on our edges with the government land. The situation we've been in, we're happy to get anything we can get because pretty much we've felt very abandoned since this whole thing started. We were told we'd get an authority to control protected wildlife, which we haven't been able to get. There's still conjecture over about the number of dogs. There's still conjecture over whether Adelaide Uni's come out now and said they're 30% domestic dogs, our dogs. So, you know, I'm going to call them wild dogs. But it's just been an absolute disgrace up there. And this is about the only tangible thing we've got so far. So we're prepared to grab onto it with both hands and take it because it's about as much as we're going to get at the moment.
And Alan, I understand that the month just gone has been the worst period for you in terms of attacks since March 2024.
Yeah, but it comes and goes. The dogs move around. The issue we've got now is that they bred in the area, so we've got a group of young dogs, family group that are staying together and causing a lot of mayhem. They're sort of breaking all the old traditional rules about what dogs did when they entered the open country, because they were single dogs that would be getting removed. Now they're a family unit that are living and very aware of what's in the environment and where to go and water and stock and stuff. So they're moving around. There's a lot of them and they're active and they're changing their pattern. They're not just grabbing a sheep to eat a little bit. They're going around and crunching lambs and stuff, not eating them. Just, we lost 20 ewes and 30 lambs in one attack in one night.
And if they can't get access to your property and your neighbour's property, does that mean that they'll just follow the fence until it comes to an end and then move on to other properties?
Yep. Yep. And that's the problem with any fencing, and that's the problem with all the fencing we've done. There's an end to the fence. So unless the whole Big Desert is encircled in a fence, we're going to have this same problem all the time. I've raised this with them, and they've got some of this technology from Western Australia, which they actually just installed now, which is an audible alarm. Motion-activated audible alarm, and they've installed a couple of them in a couple of spots to trial them and see how they go, and they reckon they might be an option at the end of the fence. But I'm absolutely with you. Any fence has got an end to it, and all the fencing we've done so far on our properties, all it's done is basically make the dogs travel in different areas or go on different roads or go to the end of the fence to get around it.
Alan Bennett there. He farms on the southern edge of the Big Desert, speaking with Angus Verley. Don Murdoch is a direct neighbour who finds himself in precisely that situation that Mr Bennett was describing. He says he's lost an estimated 30% of his lambs to wild dog attacks, but he's going to have to privately fund about 12 kilometres of exclusion fence around his own property.
We are the neighbour to that group of five that have got the subsidy to fence their property, and they haven't done it yet, but they're about to, and as a result we have to do it, otherwise we've just become the next gateway in for the dogs.
Once you do eventually privately fund and build your own exclusion fencing, is that just going to keep transferring the problem along the line?
Oh, Scotty, doesn't it? All along I've been a proponent of a coordinated effort so that doesn't happen. There's bits and pieces of fence done from our place almost out to the South Australian border, so I'm not quite sure what percentage hasn't been done, but you know, it's a no-brainer to go along and try and fill in those gaps, and I suppose then it's a South Australian problem, but they have a dog control program over there, so hopefully that would ease the problem if we do that.
And lots of farmers have said to me that they're not calling for extermination of the dingo population, but what they would like to see is the Big Desert to be entirely ring-fenced by the government. Is that what you'd like to see?
Well, I think it's only fair, especially as they brought in this protection of the dogs. So, you know, they're keen to see the dogs, well, dingoes, if you call them dingoes, protected, but they've just, well, basically surrendered to the wolves, haven't they? They've put this protection on the dogs and to hell with the consequences as far as the farmland's concerned.
Don Murdoch there, his property borders the dingo exclusion fence being built along five farms south of the Big Desert in the on the western Victorian side of the park, and he was speaking there to Angus Verley. A Victorian government spokesperson says the exclusion program is being rolled out in consultation with landowners and delivering state-of-the-art fences. They said they recognise the impact that livestock predation is having on farmers and are in regular engagement with those in northwest Victoria who have frequent predation to provide support. If you want to read more on this story, head to abc.net.au/rural. It is 6 minutes away from the 1 o'clock news with Selena Green on the Country Hour today. Did you know that roughly 80% of what we taste or perceive as flavour in food is actually aroma? Well, for businesses developing shelf-stable products, they need to be food safe, but also taste good too. Rob Shelley is a professor in food and nutrition. His students are collaborating with industry to address challenges right across the food chain.
We can extract the volatile aroma compounds out of any kind of food. We inject them into this instrument, and the idea of the instrument is to separate that complex mixture of flavour and aroma compounds into individual components.
Why do you need to do this?
Great question. This is quite important, and so a little bit of definition here. All aroma compounds are volatile, but not all, and that makes sense, right? To be able to smell something, it has to be able to pass through the air and into your nose, right? So all aroma compounds are volatile. But not all volatile compounds have a smell. And so when we extract the volatile fraction from a food product, it contains all the aroma compounds, but all the others as well. And trying to identify what's important so we can make really important flavour measurements, we use this approach to help pinpoint the important ones.
You've got something in front of you there.
One of my students prepared this. So what we're looking at here is it's essentially a home recipe of a lentil dal. And this one was prepared in February last year. We made this in our food kitchen. And inside that kitchen, we have a really fancy, it's like a pressure cooker like no other, really. It's a very, very fancy system that we place the food inside. This is inside a plastic pouch. So in the plastic pouch, we pop inside that system. It's called a rapid retort system. And we use that to sterilise the food. We make the food safe. What's interesting is that once we've done so, the food doesn't need to go in the fridge. What's your impression, or what? How would you describe in general terms canned food?
A bit bland.
Salty, bland, or really sweet. You know, if it's canned fruit, you'll find it's really, really super sweet. If it's canned vegetables, often it's really, really salty. Some people think that we add the salt or we add the sugar to help extend the life, the shelf life. That one's a myth. Those things are in there because when you heat the can to sterilise the food, it's a very slow process, okay? It's got to get to a certain temperature, and we have to hold it that kill temperature, if you like, you know, to kill the bacteria and kill the bugs. But then once we've held that time, then it takes a really, really long time also to cool down. While temperature is the enemy of bugs, it's also the enemy of flavour. It's the enemy of texture, and it's the enemy of colour. And so our approaches that we use here, using these more modern technologies, it's high temperature, short time. What we've got here, this dal, it still looks as orange as the day we cooked it, you know, well over a year ago. We have done the food safety work on this. We've done the flavour work on this. And although I haven't eaten one for a couple of months, if I get a little bit hungry, I've got a little stash of the leftovers. It's still good. Warm it up, a little bit of rice. Things are fantastic.
So are you going to check that for aroma when you do open example C?
Absolutely. And so that's what we have been doing. And you can see, like, on this bag here, we've got a whole list of dates. What we did with this is that we stored this under really controlled conditions, both at room temperature and at elevated temperature, so that we can get an indication of the shelf life of this food at room temperature. That's important. You know, our food safety team are outstanding at being able to model the food safety. And what we're doing here is that over a course of a year, we opened up these bags, we had volunteers come in to taste the food, to see if their preference of that food was shifting compared to freshly cooked. And in the background, we did all of that really delicate food chemistry to track which compounds were changing.
Rob Shelley there, Professor in Food and Nutrition at the Tasmanian Institute of Ag, chatting there to Larissa Smith. And yeah, aroma is so important. I've still got a blocked nose from the cold I had more than a week ago, and everything tastes like cardboard at the moment. I look forward to that sense coming back. That's it for me for today. Selena Green bringing you the Country Hour. Thanks for your company. The 1 o'clock news is coming up next, and then you're off to the world today. And we'll be back tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour. Have a great one.
Don't fight the static. Hear ABC local radio crystal clear on the ABC Listen app. Download now.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.